Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2011. Lecture 3, delivered on August 29, 2011. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates and the Federal Reserve.
Today, interest rates and the Federal Reserve System. I caution in the second part of this lecture about the Federal Reserve System. I am a harsh critic of the Federal Reserve, and I will assign you a couple of articles that I wrote. They are, the first one is more technical. The second one is essentially the equivalent of fire-breathing dragon on the Federal Reserve and its policies and practices over the past 11 years. But I want you to read about the Federal Reserve. Some of the criticism of it is over the top these days, abolish the Fed and all of that kind of stuff, but there is legitimate and deep concerns about what is going on now. One thing in this lecture, the textbook gives you a, I've got to remember to tell you something else, an assigned reading for the weekend, but the textbook gives you the regulatory environment of the banking system in the United States. It's just amazing how many different regulators there are and for different types of banks. It has been a crazy quilt that has been building for decades while the Federal Reserve regulates these banks, but the FDIC regulates these banks, but the states regulate these banks, unless this and that. It is insane, and the book goes through it. Now, I'm not going to go through that, and the reason is not because I don't know it. Believe me, I actually lived in that kind of an environment of regulators and did some work in there, but because it's in flux right now. There is still talk about trying to, how shall I put it, trying to streamline the regulatory process. Essentially, maybe a one-stop, all banks, if it is a bank, it will be regulated by one regulatory authority. And unfortunately, you get into total turf war when you talk about that. You got the Federal Reserve wants to protect its turf. The FDIC wants to protect its turf. The states want to protect their turf. So the idea that there could be sort of like an overall regulator of all banking institutions, it's just not happening, although they keep talking about it. But, I mean, you also got the money. The banks, some of these banks are just flush with so much money. They buy the politicians, Democrat and Republican. So, I mean, there's where reform just goes right out the window, true reform. The bottom line of it is, though, that the environment of banking is toxically bad right now. You have banks that do things that are just shockingly, for lack of a better word, just wrong. Like Bank of America has a terrible reputation for the way it is treating home mortgage people who run out of the money and then they're just thrown out willy-nilly, a lot of times wrongly, and just a mess of paperwork. The banks don't really have the mortgage papers, but they're still trying to throw people out anyway. When you get to that point in a system, it's not some evil of being capitalist that's the problem. It's a sickness in the system. Something is wrong. When you get to the point where you see this kind of wrong, and almost anyone who has any decency at all says, this is just not working. This is wrong. What's going on? That's not capitalism being horrible and we have to throw it all away and become a bunch of socialists. It's a sign that something has gone deeply wrong in the system. And that's where regulatory environments come in. Strong, but also able to work with businesses, not be there regulating them into death, but at the same time, giving business a sense of certainty. As a business consultant and as a business person, I can tell you most business people don't want the government off our backs. What they want is certainty, and they want a fair level playing ground. And they want the regulators to be there to do that so that we have competitive markets where the true business spirit can come through, when we can fight each other fang to fang and product to product on the marketplace of consumers and businesses that buy our stuff. That's not where we are now. That's why we see this sickness in the system. And that's more or less just kind of editorial, but I'm going to have you read an article this weekend. One of the most powerful writers out there in the financial world right now, I'll bet you haven't heard of. His name is Matt Taibbi. He writes for Rolling Stone magazine. He doesn't particularly care for me because I called him a foul-mouthed asshole. So he and I are at odds because I criticized him heavily for being 3 years late in finding out that the current president was not interested in banking reform and all of the reforms of our law enforcement and all of that. But that's just him. He wrote an excellent article in Rolling Stone, and I'm going to give you a link to it, talking about what's going on right now with respect to an attempt to make a settlement with a whole bunch of banks that did some really bad things over the past 10 years. It seems that there's the state's attorney, the attorneys general of the 50 states and the Federal Reserve have gotten together to work out a punishment system, a fine to lay on all these banks that did really stupid and bad and evil things. And it seems like everyone's on board, a real sellout, except for one attorney general of one state. And everyone's really on his back or her back to jump on board with this, essentially this whitewash of what happened. And he writes about why it's going down this way and what the consequences are and what, to a certain extent, you get a flavor for just how bad what happened is. And I already told you, the derivatives market, the swaps market, as far as toxic waste that's out there that is wrecking trust funds, pension funds, old people's money, what we haven't solved is about north of $63 trillion worth of toxic stuff that's still out there. And so any punishment that makes it just like a slap on the wrist for the banks and financial institutions that did that is really, really not a good solution, because it doesn't give the message that we don't ever want to have that happen again, because we're going to be fixing this mess until you're old people. Of course, you'll probably be dead in the zombie apocalypse anyway, so why do I care? Let me start you with interest rates here. And we'll do it with a simple example. Sir, I need $100. Could you give me $100 and I'll give it back to you 1 year from today? Guaranteed. Would you do that for me? I'll give you $100 back. You give me $100 today, you give me
$100. I'd rather keep it.
You're investing it in me. Look at me. My ass is worth it.
I'll give you $100.
Oh, gosh, you're not a finance major, are you? Trust me, I'm speaking from a Jewish perspective. What are you not going to charge me interest? Are you crazy? Normally, you would charge interest. And there are a lot of different reasons for interest, but at the end of the day, the most fundamental reason that there is interest on loans is this. You're giving up $100 for a year. You could have bought burgers. You could have bought chips, pop. Hell, you might even have been able to buy a friend for a while. Craigslist is very good that way. Ask Tiger Woods. You see, at the end of the day, every interest rate has at its very core just an opportunity cost of giving up some consumption. That's what every interest rate is at its very base. You can stack all kinds of other reasons on it. Default risk, maturity risk, liquidity risk, inflation expectation. You can do all that afterwards, but at the end of the day, there is this tiny little part of an interest rate, any interest rate, that represents the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. Now, what that means is that every interest rate has at its core this thing called the real interest rate. And I write R's. If I do that, in the old days we wrote R's. Anymore, apparently, I don't know who decided this, we're supposed to write K's for interest rates these days. I don't know why. Life was easier in the old days. PowerPoints were on stone tablets. And we didn't have integers. We had binary numbers, zeros and ones. Sometimes we didn't have the zeros, but you could do a lot with just ones. Never mind. Anyway, case of real. This is what I don't know why I did this one day in a seminar. I said, this is the Scooby-Doo. You know, were it real? Obviously, it went over there just like it did here. The hell with you. Okay, the real interest rate at the heart of all of it, not adjusting, not adding an inflation or anything like that, not adding risks of any kind, just giving up dinner. That's what it is. So when I asked you about that $100, you weren't concerned about dinner tonight. You won't have it. I will, but you won't. You see, you'll charge me something, a little bit, a tiny bit maybe, but something. And this is a very short-term interest rate we're dealing with here. What would happen in a sort of like a flash? Now, we do add on top of that. We'll never see this case of real. We actually can't see it. It's not theoretical. It's just shrouded. It always has at least one other thing, usually a lot of other things, that are tacked on top of it. We don't see the pure real interest rate. Econometrics can allow us to back into it and figure out pretty much exactly what it is. But in itself, it's always got stuff stacked on it, so we can't really see the real interest rate on its own, naked in our faces. The thing that would have to be there, if nothing else, is an expected inflation premium. And I write this, and normally we write this as a pi e, an expected inflation premium. In other words, there would always be stacked on this, if nothing else, the expectation of your loss of purchasing power. Understand this, and this goes back to my first lecture. The actual inflation rate is irrelevant. What matters, and the only thing that matters, is expectations of inflation. And that's where you get into some serious dangers in terms of the politics of interest rate manipulation. Because once you get an expectation of inflation embedded, you can say anything you want, promise the world, and actually do the right thing to get rid of the inflation, and the expectation can still remain for a while. On the other hand, the other bad side, which is where we are now, is that when the expectation is not there, you can play games with the money supply and create inflationary things, and the expectation will stay low, actually, for a long time. We still have a very low expectation on the inflation in our economy, even though for at least 7 years, we have been pursuing a wildly inflationary monetary policy. The reality is that we could get by with it because it isn't real inflation. It isn't the money supply that matters in the short run. It's what people expect. And as long as people expect very little inflation, the politicians and the Federal Reserve can play very inflationary games. Let me explain it this way. You work for me. You've been working at my shop, and I figure, well, you know, you're making $200 a week, and I'm overpaying you, obviously, at that. $200 a week, and I give, and you, I, you come to me, okay, well, I'm going to give you a raise. Inflation last year was 2%. So I'll give you a 2% raise. And you're happy with that, and you go back out to the slave mines where I have you work. And a year later, inflation has gone to 4%. So when you come in, I say, well, I'm going to give you a 4% increase because inflation last year was 4%. The next year, inflation is 6%. You come in and I tell you, well, I'm going to give you 6%. Do you see how I am screwing you over? Do you see it? What do you think inflation is going to be forward, what you will have to face with the money that I am giving you? 6% or something else? Someone said it, 8%. You see what's going on is that you, if you have the market, the negotiating power, aren't going to ask for 6%. You're going to look forward to 8%. Well, you say, I want 8%. And I say, bite me. I just heard the chairman of the Federal Reserve. He said that we are going to engage in the moral equivalent of war against inflation. And moral equivalent of war, meow, against inflation. Well, this is the same Federal Reserve that has been running inflation up the lanyard for the last 3 years on you. Do you really want to believe them? Or do you want to believe your lying eyes? You'll believe yourself. Your expectation will be driven by your experience and your forward-looking concept. You see how inflation expectations will begin to embed? And then if the Federal Reserve really does get down to work on fighting inflation, you don't know that. You only know what they tell you, and they have lost their credibility. So you're still going to fight for 8%. Not what happened last year, not the promises of the Federal Reserve's people. You're going to operate on your expectations of inflation. And you see, that is what drives all interest rates, that drives stock prices, that drives pretty much everything that happens in your life is expectations. Not what historically has happened, but what you think is going to happen. Markets are driven by the expectations, not by the realities of the world around them. You put these two percentages together, the real interest rate and expected inflation premium, and you see the first interest rate that actually exists in the real world, at least a close proxy of it. This is called the risk-free rate. The risk-free rate. It is the interest rate on a very short-term, absolutely riskless instrument. You say, well, there's inflation. That's not a risk. Inflation is just a fever. Now, where do we see this? A proxy of it is in a very short-term treasury bill. In other words, if you saw the annualized interest rate on like a three-month treasury bill, one of those short-term borrowings of the United States government, that would be close to the risk-free rate because there's no default premium, no maturity premium, no liquidity premium. That was one of the things that was just kind of stunning, was this talk about the government defaulting on its debt. Talk about it was bad enough, but the possibility that you could say that there was a default premium in Treasury bills, oh God, that would cause an awful lot of real misery. Fortunately, the markets knew that was all smoke and mirrors and political posturing. The only people who were excited about the possibility of the government defaulting were some crazy asses who were hoping for, against hope, that it could actually happen. Short-term treasury bill. And in fact, as you'll see later in the course, we actually use the short-term T-bill because we need this interest rate right here, this risk-free rate, for one of the most important financial calculation formulas that we have. It's called the capital asset pricing model. Even though it's simple and simplistic and it's old school, it's still used to this day out there in the real world, so it has teeth, so we pay attention to it. And this animal right here is in that formula, so we keep our eye on T-bill rates all the time to make sure that everything is okay with our formulas. We want to have that updated at all times. Before I go on, I got to bring up a couple of concepts here, some terminology. First thing I have to do is distinguish between among different types of debt instruments. A bill versus a note versus a bond. A bill is less than 1 year in duration. Actually, I say less than or equal to. So if you borrowed money for 3 months, it's called a bill. So if you're, for example, if you buy a treasury bill, that represents some kind of a debt instrument that was very short term in length, a year or less. A note is between 1 year and, I don't know, I put the number at 5 to 7. Seven is old school. I've had some people tell me, no, it's 5 now, about 7 years. So, for example, a car loan is actually a note. A car loan is a note. Because most of those are like anywhere from 3 or 4 years on up to 6 years. Now, a bond is greater than 7 years. You can have bonds that are 10, 15, 20. A 30-year mortgage is a bond. A home mortgage, that's a bond. Corporations very typically borrow in the 15 to 30-year bracket. And sometimes there's some bonds out there, 50. I know there are some, I haven't seen any of them myself, but there are some 100-year bonds, longer than that even. But interestingly enough, watching how corporations construct their debt structure is interesting. For example, right now you see companies borrowing on the long end. And that would probably indicate that what they're expecting is that later it would cost more to borrow. So they're getting money now on a long-term basis for capital projects down the road. Here's the next part of it. If you are the borrower in a loan contract, that means you are the issuer. The borrower is the issuer. Because what is happening is that when you borrow money, let's say you borrow for a car, you've had your eye on one of the, okay, let me think. For you, you've had your eye on one of those little smart cars. God, I hate those things. I want to run over one of them. You know what? I had RPGs in the Army that could take one of those son of a bitches out with one shot. Excellent, cute little cars. I could see you in one of those. Okay. Your dream. You want a babe machine, that's it. So you borrow for that. $10,000, I don't know, how much are those things? I mean, those Mini Coopers are stupidly expensive. I mean, like $30,000. I'm not going to drive something that makes me look like a twerp, pay $30,000 to look like that. No. Okay, let's say it's $15,000. You borrow $15,000 from a bank. What is technically happening is that you are the writer and then the issuer of a security. You say, well, no, I go to the bank and they've got the paperwork. No, they're just taking care of it for you. You are literally the writer, the issuer of the note in this case, because it's going to be about 5 years you're going to borrow for. The bank is then the buyer of that security. And the price that the bank is paying is what you need for the loan, plus some for them. You know, they got to make a living. So, in other words, the price to them is about $15,000. You are offering a security for $15,000. You write it, you issue it. So you are the writer, the issuer, the seller. Writer, issuer, seller. And I'll use any of those terms. And the other side of the contract is a bank that agrees to be the buyer, the purchaser, the lender. So the borrower is the writer, and I'm using different terms that you'll hear me use. Writer, issuer, seller. The lender is the purchaser or buyer. Usually on some prearranged level this works. Now, know this. These securities don't always have to have paper involved in them. Usually they do with banks, there's going to be a paper, notwithstanding some of the unbelievable fiascos where these banks can't show that they actually have mortgages. But then the lender becomes the holder of the security. You become the obligatee of the obligator of the security, and you have an agreement on how you're going to pay this thing back. So there you are. You are actually the issuer of the security of a loan. Let's take it back to this. Now that makes a lot of sense here with a note. You're the issuer of the note for to borrow the car. For a mortgage, you're actually the issuer of a promissory bond. We call it a promissory note. That's old language. But it's a promissory bond. Attached to that is what's called a mortgage agreement, which essentially collateralizes the promissory instrument. Bond, that would be, a mortgage would be a bond, a 30-year corporate bond. Some corporations issue notes all the time. But a bill. You could say, I got a bill in the mail for my electricity. Well, actually, you issued that bill. You're the seller of the bill. No, I got it in the mail. The electric company, they issued the bill. No, all they did was give you a representation for the current period of the amount due that they lent you on the bill you issued. And you're saying that deep intellectual question, yeah. In other words, when you use electricity every day, the electric company is lending you the value. And at the end of every month, what they're going to do is they're going to send you a statement that says, this is the bill that you issued, accumulated through the month. Now we would like to have our money. We bought your bill. You issued the bill. We had already agreed to that by making you one of our customers. Now here is a representation of that bill that you issued. And now we are calling it due. If that makes sense to you, be worried. But that's actually what's going on. And once you get that thinking straight, a lot of financial concepts have a very different meaning, or at least a subtly different meaning. I'm going to show you something right here, right now. I got Denny's money tonight. Yeah, who's good? I want you to do me a favor here. Sir, what does it say? This is a $1 bill. But no, it's not. What does it say at the top of that?
Federal Reserve note.
Federal Reserve note. It's not a bill. It's a note. They used to be bills. Why did they used to be bills? Because it could be flipped over into silver instantly. How? You just get 4 silver quarters. The quarters used to be made of silver. So did the dime. So did the half dollars. I could flip it over. It was a very short-term instrument. Now, this stands on its own. And tell me what that means, a Federal Reserve note. What would that mean? Can you tell me? First of all, what's its duration? What's its duration? Anyone want to take a stab? 1 to 7 years. In other words, this will come due in 1 to 7 years. So that means that it's kind of in an intermediate length in time. Now I'd like you, madam, I'd like you to do me a favor. Read that fine print right there. What did that say?
This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
It's legal tender. In other words, you can use it to pay anything. Anything you can use to pay this, as long as it's less than a dollar. Now here's what this is. Essentially, this thing is issued by the Federal Reserve note. The Federal Reserve will satisfy the obligation in a period of 1 to 7 years. Does anyone know how the Federal Reserve will satisfy this obligation in 1 to 7 years? Can you tell me that part? And I'll bet you'll be surprised. Yeah.
It destroy
it? And, well, it can't just destroy it. What will it do? You know, they tear up the contract when you pay off your loan on your car. But what's the predicate that makes this after they, if they're going to destroy it, why do they destroy it? What's done in its place? Yes, they print another one, probably 2. And you're thinking to yourself, no, wait a minute here. Listen here, mofo. You're telling me the Federal Reserve, as the agency of the United States Treasury, is actually paying this off by printing a couple more of them. You say, well, you're not saying that, are you? And I'm saying, oh, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. You see, that's how the federal government is being funded, is through these instruments right here. And when they come due, they just issue a new set. Go. That is exactly the result cause of inflation, which I will get into later here in this lecture if I have the time, otherwise on Wednesday. But here's the upshot. The only thing that creates inflation is more money, a growth rate of the money supply in excess of the real growth rate of the economy. In other words, if the economy grows at 3%, the money supply grows at 3%, that's great. But if the money supply grows at a rate greater than 3%, then that the excess, the overhang, is inflation. It just eventually creates inflation. But remember, inflation isn't what counts. It's the expectation. So as long as there's an expectation lag, they can actually boost the economy. That's called short-run Keynesian policy. In the long run, we have classical result. Inflation eventually comes through, and real output goes back to what it was before. On the other hand, as you will read this weekend, if you produce less money than the real growth rate of the economy, you will get a deflation. Now that, of course, deflation, just to give you an idea, inflation and deflation, they're both bad. But if you want to talk about which one economists recommend we stay in another galaxy away from, it would be deflation. You're going to see that in the period from about 2004 especially until 2008, the money supply was growing at a rate. Well, which do you think it was? Was it growing at a rate in excess of the real growth rate of the economy, or was it growing slower than the real growth rate of the economy? Which was it? Just off the top of your head, what do you think? If you said faster, you were right. If you said slower, you were right. And then again, you say, nah. There was this massive, very complex monetary aggregate called M3. That was growing at a staggering rate, a rate greater than it had ever grown in history, uncontrolled. And you know how the Federal Reserve dealt with it in the spring of 2008? 6, they stopped publishing the number. No one uses it. Oh, you're bleeding to death. Let's cover you up. But if you look at M1, the money that's cash and demand deposits, that was growing at about 0%. So the money that people and businesses at the line level of the economy use, it was not growing as fast as the economy, essentially slowly choking the economy to death. At the high end, at M3, the money supply was growing at a rate that was just incomprehensibly large. What was causing that? We were buying so much money, so many products from China, because it was pegging its currency at about a third of its actual value, that our dollars were flowing over there in what are called euro dollars, into the central bank of China, which then lent them back to us. That was the first rung of the catastrophe. Essentially, a money supply that's M3, euro dollars, was growing at a staggering rate, and no one wanted to talk much about it. The second part of it was that this euro money is highly illiquid, which meant that the banks, when they had this overseas and here, they had all this money, but they couldn't use it directly. It's like having a house, you can't buy McDonald's with it. So what do? You write side bets. You write them out the ass. You back the M3. You use the M3 to back anything you can. What did they use it to back? What did they use all of this illiquid money to back? Collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, swaps. That's what happened, to the tune of $63 trillion in a period of less than a decade. You'll read about it. I show the numbers. I show even what M3 was doing after the Fed stopped publishing it. There's a very good service out there called Shadow Government Statistics that was still publishing M3 and the staggering run-up that was happening. It was easy to call. The system was going to just snap. By 2007, business investment in the United States was beginning to buckle. And by the beginning of 2008, it was just in, the economy was screaming, we're going to have a disaster. I started writing about it. I wrote articles in 2007, and I finally published my last warning in May of 2008. We're going to buckle. It's going to break. And on September 15th of 2008, it began at about, it began at about 10 o'clock. Some of the quant jocks at the Federal Reserve in New York started noticing this really, really heavy draw from money markets. I'm talking about a draw that got in a period from about 10 a.m. to 12 a.m. to noon Eastern time. It hit maybe $500 billion of drawdown of money market money. No one could tell exactly where it was going, but it was essentially, if that had continued another couple of hours, the banks just across the United States, they just wouldn't have had the money. They would have closed their doors. It would have been essentially the banking system would have collapsed. Not essentially, it would have collapsed. And if it had collapsed, essentially as the sun worked its way across the planet, the banking system of the rest of the world would have fallen. As the sun went that way, you would have seen Asia's banking system in Hong Kong, Japan buckle. Within minutes, they would have buckled because they're fragile anyway, because the Chinese banking system is basically nothing but a pile of American dollars. And then as it swung across Eastern Europe into Europe, the euro, the Bundesbank, the Central Bank of Europe would have collapsed. African banks would have fallen very rapidly. It would have been essentially the end of the world as you know it. At about noon, the Federal Reserve shut down the window. No one was allowed to draw any more money out of the money markets. It was over. Right there, they just stopped, said, no one, enough. And fortunately, that stopped the disaster. That stopped the break right there. Of course, the system was already destroyed on the inside, which is why people started seeing what was happening. In Congress that afternoon, the House of Representatives was put under martial law. As a matter of fact, Jeff Sessions, a congressman, directly asked then-Speaker Nancy Pelosi, "Madam Speaker, is the House under martial law?" She refused to answer him at that point. And then they essentially, Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, and several others came in and said, told what had happened in a secret session. One congressman, Dennis Kucinich, refused to attend the secret session. He said, "You're telling secrets. This is not right. I'm leaving." Everyone else attended. The first reaction of Congress was they said, "This is 9/11 all over again. You set this up. You lied to us, and then you got us to pass one Patriot Act after another, and it is now as it was then." As one congressman said in the hours after 9/11 in the House of Representatives, "This is bullshit," as he walked out the door. And they felt the same thing was going on with this banking crisis. You have bracketed this administration. Crisis at the beginning to get what you wanted. Crisis at the end so the banking system gets another $1 trillion. They didn't believe them. That was why there was essentially a lockdown of the House of Representatives until everyone was convinced that it was real. And it was real. And so we had about an $800 billion bailout, which was essentially a Band-Aid on a $63 trillion disaster. And that's where we are now. The federal budget deficits are just way out of control simply because we're just shoveling money in to save banks, save financial institutions. At the same time, we're trying to shovel money into the economy to wake it back up. It's a dual disaster, and we're trying to fix it. We'll see if we do. Now, let me take you through the risk structure of an interest rate. Did you know this? On September the 15th, we almost had a zombie apocalypse. You should see. You think it wasn't a zombie apocalypse, you should see in day traders when they lose all their money. They go zombie. The risk structure of an interest rate. Here we have the wall between a short-term government rate and a rate that you would borrow at in the open market. The first part of that is the default premium. The risk that you will not pay part or all of your cash flow. So a bank or any lender is going to put a little bit of a premium in there for the chance that you're not going to pay off all the loan. Now, if it's a high quality source borrower, or if there is a guarantor, that default premium will be very low. It will still be there, but it will be very low. So, for example, a student loan has a very low default premium because it's backed by the government. And, of course, if you don't pay, then the government comes and seizes your ass and turns you into Soylent Green. But it's still there. Now, higher risk, for example, a credit card. A lot of the credit card's ridiculously high interest rate is just because there's a very high probability relative to other instruments that you won't pay all or part of your credit card bill off. So there's your default premium right there. That adds something to it. Mortgages. Now, do home mortgages typically have a high or a low default premium? Let me ask you this. What would you think? Talk to me.
Low.
Why?
That's
part of it, but why isn't there a high risk of default? Why isn't there a high risk of losing money on a home loan? The home, it's an asset back, go ahead. Say that again. Yeah, that equity is in there. After a few years, you hope that you're right side up, although that doesn't happen these days. There are a couple of other reasons, interestingly enough. One is many home loans are backed by some federal program, FHA, VA, so the bank is covered there. And it amazes me how many financial pundits, home mortgages, banks have lost a lot of money on these home mortgages. Did you know that almost every mortgage in the United States, part of your payment is a payment on an insurance premium that pays the bank if you default. It's called MAGIC, the Mortgage Guarantee Insurance Corporation, or one of those. Any loan that is for a loan-to-value ratio above 80%, you as the borrower have to pay every month as part of your payment a premium that will guarantee that the mortgage company, the bank, or whatever it is, will be covered if you default. At least to a large extent, it will cover the bank. Interestingly, most people don't know that they are not required to have this, to pay this, after their home to value, their loan to value ratio goes below 80%. Most people don't know that they're paying it anyway, so they pay this mortgage premium through the entire life of their loan, and essentially they're paying for something that, one, they don't need, the law doesn't require them to pay, and would be ridiculous, the bank would never use it anyway. It just collects money for these mortgage insurance companies. And it's just something that's out there, so you might want to tell your parents, if your home to value loan to value ratio is below 80%, are you still paying mortgage insurance? They would say, what's that? And then you could say, well, Professor C said, and find out if they are. You would be amazed. I think there was a study, what was it? It was just an unbelievable percentage of people who have really loan-to-value ratios below 80%, it's just a staggering percentage that still pay mortgage insurance premiums. They've never thought about it. They never knew they had it. They were paying it. Anyway, enough of that one. Let's go to the next one, R sub M. This one is interesting. This is what I used to refer to, and of course now I'm much more dignified. I used to refer to this as the two-way screw. It's an odd thing about interest rates. Let me do it this way. And I'll explain. The length of a loan is in and of itself a source of risk. The longer the loan is, the riskier it is to the lender. And it's not because of default. It's because of something else. Let me first start out this way. Historically speaking, the typical home a person who's got a mortgage on a home holds the mortgage for 7 years before they do a refi or move. That's just on average. And that's a historical thing. About 7 years is how long people hold their mortgages before something happens. Like I said, they move to a bigger house, or they might refi when interest rates are decent. So here we go. Let's see what happens in a volatile interest rate environment. Suppose that you were planning to hold your mortgage for 7 years. You want to be an average person. You won't be, but you're trying to be. So you're planning to hold for 7 years. Now, I'm your lender. I'm the bank. Interest rates go through the roof. Now, you see, as a bank, I would really, really am excited about you paying off your mortgage at 7 years, because then I can lend the money to someone else at a higher rate. Because this son of a bitch is locked in at 5%. Really? You know what? Interest rates are 11% now. You know, you really ought to pay off this loan. Really? I want you to pay it off? What are you going to do? Are you going to pay it off? No, I don't want no 5% loan. I want 11%. What are you going to do? You're going to hold the loan for a while, aren't you? Hell, 5 kids? We can still live in this 3-bedroom house. No problem at all. You see what you're going to do if interest rates go through the roof? I, the bank, really want you to pay off your loan so I can lend the money out at a higher rate. You are not going to do that. You're not crazy. So I am screwed as the banker when interest rates go up, which they are more likely to do the longer time goes on. As the maturity of the loan increases, there's more likelihood that interest rates are going to go up. Now let's talk about the other side of it. You, sir, I lent you money at 7%, but interest rates have dropped. I, as the banker, want you to hold on to that 7% loan. What are you going to do if interest rates get to 4% on a 30-year fixed rate? What are you going to do? Refi. You're going to refi right away. Or maybe buy a bigger house. Here I am with a 7% cash flow on you. And what do? You greedy son of a dog. You refi. So what do I have to relend the money at when I get it back from you? Do I lend it at 7%? No, 4%. You see the two-way screw? The longer time goes on, the more likely interest rates are going to go down and or up. In either scenario, as the lender, I am not happy. Because, you see, that's the difficulty of this. By the way, I was driving my car today and I got hit by this car. Out of the car comes this midget. He said, I'm not happy. And I said, I know you're not. You're grumpy. And that's when the fight started. Anyway, God, you're a rough crowd. So the maturity premium gets worse as time goes on because there is more of a probability. The probability is higher that the volatility is going to run adverse to my interest. Up or down, I'm hurt. And the longer the time, the more chance there is that interest rates are going to go up and or down. Probably both, so I get hit both ways on this kind of a thing. Matter of fact, let me go to this one. The last one is what is, I put an R there, a K. The last one is, I think the book calls this the illiquidity premium. I used to call it the liquidity premium, but I'll put an L here with it. It's illiquidity or whatever. Now, first of all, let me give you a definition here. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Let me show you this. You see this thing right here? That's liquid. That's a $50. I've got 50. Oh, yeah. I got friends tonight. Yes. I can convert that into meal instantly. High liquidity. Cash is the most liquid of all instruments. Now, in terms of liquidity, the only thing that comes close would be a short-term government debt instrument, like a T-bill, a treasury bill. Now, those can't, if a bank has those, they're tier one capital. They're highly liquid, but it can't lend them. But nevertheless, a T-bill, if you're in brokering or if you've got money market accounts, sweeps, I mean, those T-bills are just like water. You can convert them into another asset just right away. You can convert a T-bill into cash. You can convert cash into T-bills literally with just a quick phone call, even a click of the mouse nowadays. So that's liquidity at its high end, high liquidity. Liquidity at its low end, be like a house, the double wide trailer you're dreaming of having with the double wide woman and all that. I know, I'll call you a dreamer, it will happen. You're getting a degree from Illinois State. But you were taught by the worst professor in history. But and also, there are other things that are highly liquid. Don't get me wrong. Illiquid does not necessarily at all mean not worth anything. Remember why I was telling you about that M3 money? That was one of the problems, was banks had all of this capital that wasn't what we call tier one capital. In other words, highly liquid capital. They were just swimming in it. They were worth a fortune on their books, but no one knew how to look at the books to see tier one versus higher tiers of capital. And so this idea that saying, well, people asked for it when they were in these banks and investing in these. No, people don't understand that kind of stuff. But that doesn't mean that it's not valuable. For example, you woman, you know what? You are highly illiquid. highly. But you're still valuable. I mean, the present value of future expected cash flows from you is significant. An insurance policy on you probably maybe $6 million. I mean, that's how much value you have. But I can't get that out of you right now. I can't turn you into a burger and fries and a small chocolate frosty. I could try. Well, I don't know. You know, some of those guys there, they probably see sure. But the thing of it is, you see the idea there? The value is there. It's just that you can't convert it right away. And that's one of the things that's going to be frustrating in your lives is having these things that are valuable, but you just can't convert them into cash. So that's liquidity. Now, let me get back to what this means in terms of debt instruments. You, madam, you are a corporation, a Fortune 500 corporation, a highly valued corporation. You need to borrow money for 30 days. And there is actually a security out there where very large creditworthy companies borrow real quick money. Does anyone know what those are? What that security is called? It's a huge market. And I'll talk more about it later. Have any of you ever heard of commercial paper? It's a very fast, quick, like IOU types of loans. Okay, now you're going to issue commercial paper for 30 days, and let's say it's $10 million. $10 million. Okay. Now, looking for an investor. I'm looking for someone who looks wealthy. Not a damn soul in this room. Okay. Now, she has come to you for $10 million on commercial paper. 30 days, and then a little interest rate, and she'll pay back. And here I come. I am a former professor who kind of got a little too burned out one night. There was an experiment, and it just went wrong. And so I'm like kind of live on the edge of society now, and I kind of, you son of a bitch. Yeah, I got an idea. $10 million, flip it. 30 days from now, I'll pay it back. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'll write you an IOU. Here, give me your hand. I'll write it right here on your hand. Yeah, give me that damn hand. Oh, I don't know where your hand is being. So I signed this. Oh, I signed an IOU. Now, which one are you going to charge a higher interest rate to? This fine, upstanding corporation or to me? Yes, because there's a very good chance that after 30 days, not only am I not going to pay you back, I'm not going to even be alive. So you see, that is a liquidity premium. And it tends to cause interest rates to be higher for higher risk borrowers. That's why, for example, you'll see loans at very high interest rates at pawn shops, and yet you'll see loans for the same amount at lower rates and lending to more creditworthy people at nice banks and credit unions. It's just because of that liquidity. That lender, if he really needs to get rid of that commercial paper, anyone will buy commercial. It's a very active market. One investor could buy it and then 5 days later flip it, and the money will be there within minutes. Someone will pick up commercial paper. Try to sell that IOU that I gave you. No one's going to buy it. You're stuck with it for 30 days hoping that I actually pay it off, which I don't, of course. I mean, well, are you stupid or something? So liquidity premium is the ease with which a lender can sell the loan to another party. Now I'm going to take you to the last thing about interest rate. It's one of those important concepts in finance. One of those concepts that is so important that it's something that you should consider getting tattooed on your ass. Literally. The tat parlor, they'll give you a discount. I know. Yeah, just be careful. You know, make sure they use alcohol. Look. Some of you have a calculator. I would appreciate it if you would help me out here because I do really suck at arithmetic when I try to do it in my head. I mean, this is just arithmetic. This isn't calculus or anything like that. It's very simple. Take all this off the board. Okay, we're going to go back and do this with treasury bills. Treasury bills, T-bills. And because they are, there's basically no risk in them. And they also have an interesting feature that is kind of rare. They are what is called a discount instrument. Now, mostly when you think about loans, you get a loan and then you pay off a little bit every month, some interest and some principal. Well, that's consumer. With corporate, all you do is pay the interest, and then at the end of the life of the loan, you pay off the principal with one last interest payment. So there's a difference there. But this is something fundamentally different. With this kind of a borrowing, which the government does, with these short-term, these treasury bills, these T-bills, they actually sell them at a discount to par, and your interest is the difference between what you buy it at and $1,000. Unless I say otherwise in this course, the face value of all debt is $1,000. In other words, money is borrowed in $1,000 blocks. That's true in the corporate world, that's true in the government world. With consumer loans, it's a little different. We'll talk about that later. But in the world of business, in the world of government, money is always bought in blocks, lent with a promise of $1,000 back. So if a corporation wants to borrow $1 million, it actually issues 1,000 certificates. It actually isn't quite that simple, but for now it will be. Damn it. So we're going to have a treasury auction. A treasury auction. And we're going to talk about the price of the instrument, the price. And then we're going to talk about the face value of the instrument. And we're going to talk about the dollar interest. And then we're going to talk about the yield. And I am the cashier at the treasury auction. I'm the cashier at this treasury auction. And you, madam, are at the auction to buy a treasury bill. I, the cashier, am named Mabel. You come up to the table and you see, look at these treasury bills. They're due in exactly 1 year, and you're thinking of buying one. And you look around the table, and I say, well, how are you doing there? It's good to see you at our auction. Would you like to buy one of these treasury bills right here? We've got them on special today. They are $975. Would you like one? And you say, okay. Earl, bag of treasury bill for this young lady. There you go. Come up to the cash register. Oh, you don't have to. I'll take care of it from here. Will that be cash or credit card or debit card? Well, good girl. $950. That'll be your price. Would you like that in a bag? And so I put it in a bag for you and I send you on your way. 1 year later, you get paid off. What's the face value of the instrument? $1,000. Always $1,000. 40 years from now, I'm going to see you walking along in Chicago and I'm going to catch you. What? What's the face value of a debt instrument? You're going to say, who the hell are you? I was your professor. Wait. Turn around. Put my tube back in my kidney. I feel it leaking down my butt. Good girl. Now. $1,000. Now talk to me. How much interest then, therefore, did you earn in dollars in that year? How much? $50. So now let's do the yield. How much dollar interest did you earn? $50. How much did you invest? Don't say $1,000 or I will eat your ass. What did you invest? No, I never was a gourmet. $950. I want you to take $950 divided by 50. What do you get? 5%. Say it specifically. Exactly. Always two decimal places as a percentage. Always. What is it? 5.26%, is it?
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay, you come back to the auction next year. Oh, there you are again. Well, I'll be damned. My goodness, you should be using oil of Olay. You're getting older. Yes, indeed. Okay. Well, you notice that there's hardly anyone there this time. The Chinese aren't there. The Arabs aren't there. The Japanese. They're all saying, oh, you'll suck, America. So I'm having to offer a really big sale. $900 for one of these T-bills. What do you get back at the end of that year? $1,000. So how much interest did you earn? $100. So let's talk about the yield. How much interest did you earn, did you say? $100. How much did you invest? So what's your interest rate? 11.11%. Well, spank me, Jesus. As the price of a debt instrument goes down, the yield goes up. Always and forever, everywhere in the universe, when price goes down, yield goes up. You get that tattooed on you. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.